Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Later in the hour, Van Northcross talks about his debut novel, a murder mystery titled Never Fault a Creature. But first, we get a preview of the 19th annual Martha's Vineyard International Film Festival, which runs September 3rd through the 8th. Joining us is the festival's executive director and founder, Richard Paradise. Welcome back.
Hey, welcome.
19th.
Thank you.
I can't believe it's the 19th already.
I know.
Seems like not that long ago we were talking about the first one.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. We've been doing this annually. For 19 years, Mindy. I can't believe it. I know. We're old.
No. So this is such an interesting film festival because there's not really a lot of opportunity to get out and see international films. And the theme this year is other places, other people.
Yes, yes. Well, that's pretty much been sort of our tagline for pretty much 19 years, that we go out and we try to find the best representations of world cinema that can bring our viewers, our audiences on Martha's Vineyard into the world of a particular character that might be going through sort of a universal experience, but their perspective is totally international. It's culturally different from ours, different from an American point of view. So whether we're going to Bangladesh or we're going to Senegal or to France or, you know, wherever, we try to, you know, give that viewer an opportunity to see what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. How are people dealing with various issues, family issues, relationship issues that might be somewhat similar, but totally different culturally.
Yeah.
And we've got some great examples of that in the festival.
And so when did you become interested in international films?
Oh, wow. You know, I first started watching foreign language films with subtitles when I was a teenager back in the New Jersey, New York City area. And I'd always been a film buff. I mean, I watched old Hollywood films on TV at first and then in theaters when I was just a mere child. But as I became more sophisticated in my taste, I started to go to New York City. I started to visit some of the smaller theaters in New York City that were showing these wonderful films from Europe, from Asia. And I've always been fascinated because basically, I grew up in a very depressed neighborhood in New Jersey, northern New Jersey, and my family, my parents weren't very culturally oriented, but I always felt like there was a broader world out there, and I wanted to explore that world, but I couldn't do it as a traveler. We didn't have the means. We never traveled, really. I think we went to Lake George one time for a vacation, and that was a big deal, but in any case, this was my opportunity to see the world via film. And I've kind of always tried to keep that kind of spirit alive in the festival.
Yeah. And so you open the festival with Mighty Afrin in the Time of the Floods. That's at 4:30 on September 3rd. Tell us a little about that film.
Yes. Well, this is a traditional coming-of-age film. But this young woman, I think she's 12. She could be 12 or 14. But this young woman has been devastated. Her family's been devastated. Her village has been devastated by flooding in Bangladesh. And she makes the decision to leave her village and go to the city, the large city in Bangladesh, the capital city, which is a mass of humanity and people and craziness, but she doesn't know anyone there. So she makes friends with different people and she learns to survive, you know, and it's really a film about perseverance and survival and how this young woman, and it's stated as a documentary, but it's really a docudrama. Mm-hmm. Because the director did work with the young woman, who's the actress who plays the young woman. So she did actually experience these things herself, but there's a script. And so it's kind of part documentary, part narrative. And it makes for a very thrilling film. And the scenes of the monsoons, I guess you'd call them monsoons, mm-hmm. the rain, the flooding is unbelievable. I mean, it's really true life experience there. So it's a great way. Again, we have not over the years played many films from Bangladesh, maybe one in 19 years. Wow. So I'm always looking to reach out to other corners of the world. For instance, we have a film from Senegal. normally there's not a lot of African produced films that are coming into the United States each year, and this one's a good one. And so
I bet people wonder how you find these films. I mean, so you've seen a lot of them.
Yes.
What, at other film festivals and things? Yeah.
Yep. Film festivals. I go to some of the big key film festivals annually. Sundance Film Festival, of course. I go to Berlin. I have gone to film festivals in Asia and Korea specifically. Mm. I've gone to film festivals in Latin America, mostly the one in Colombia, which is representative of a lot of the Latin American films. And there's nothing better than seeing a film with an audience to judge how our audience will appreciate it and sort of engage with it. And, you know, of course, when I'm programming our festival or any film throughout the year at the Film Center, I'm always thinking of my audience. Not right. me personally, but my audience and how they would react to it, if they would find it entertaining, enlightening, educational, you know, and that's how I approach it.
Yeah. All right. So also on opening day at 7:30, you've got It's a Sabbath Queen, a documentary. Took 21 years?
21 years, yes. And I'm happy to say that the director, who lives in New York City, Sandy Dubowski, is going to join us. Mm. And so the audience will have a chance to ask, you know, how do you sustain this project over 21 years? Now, I'm sure that he was working on other projects as a filmmaker, a documentarian. Many times you have many projects that you're working on at different stages. But he actually followed this individual who basically the quandary was, do I follow my authentic self, which is to be a LGBTQ drag queen, basically. Mm-hmm. Do I follow my instincts to do that, or do I follow my ancestry? Because his family has produced 37 generations of rabbis. Mm. And his oldest brother is the rabbi for the state of Israel.
Wow.
So this is not just, you know, any rabbi and not any family. This family goes back so far historically. And so he has this quandary. And so he tries to balance both. Mm-hmm. And it's a very entertaining film. It's a very insightful film into, you know, what it means to follow in so-called your father's footsteps. But in this case, 37 generations of mm-hmm. father's mm-hmm. footsteps. And it's going to be great to have the film maker here. And the filmmaker also has friends on Martha's Vineyard. So there's going to be a nice little reunion there and connection.
You often have filmmakers with the films. And I imagine that's a whole nother experience. You see this film and then you get to talk to the filmmaker. You know, sometimes you walk away from a film and you wonder about this or that. So that must be an interesting part of the film festivals.
For
these
sure.
Conversations.
Oh yes, for sure. Conversations are a key element of any film festival, and whether you have the filmmaker or you have the subject in the film, or you have someone who can add kind of an enriching sort of analysis of the topic, you know, whether it's a, you know, someone locally, an expert, I hate to use the word expert, but someone who can add on to what you've already seen. And we always try to, you know, sort of try to maneuver and manipulate that. But unfortunately, a lot of these films, of course, because they are international and they were produced internationally and the filmmakers are in Senegal mm-hmm. or in Bangladesh or in France, it's very difficult sometimes to get them to come to the festival logistically. We usually have a lot more luck getting the short film mm-hmm. filmmakers. The short film program, 9 films this year. I think we have 5 of the 9 mm-hmm. filmmakers coming to Martha's Vineyard
to
join us.
Do you Zoom for some of these?
We do. We do. We have a couple filmmakers that we've set up with the Zoom Q&A, which actually works very well. Just a couple weeks ago, we Zoomed with a filmmaker from Budapest, that went extremely well. So that does bridge the logistics hurdles.
Did you use Zoom before COVID?
We use Skype, which is something similar to Zoom. Zoom is kind of sort of taken over that particular market. But yeah, we've been using Skype and Zoom. probably for a good 10 years now to bring filmmakers to the film center.
That's great. And I imagine, you know, it's, as we know, a lot of time putting together what you're going to show at the film festivals, but scheduling in order which films are going to go where. Like you got documentary here, you got a comedy, you got a drama. Is that, do you do that yourself? Do you have a panel? It's just you?
Just me. Yeah. except when people complain and I said, well, that was the committee's decision. No, it's I do curate the entire festival.
So what are you keeping in mind as you're curating?
Well, you know, I'm looking for diversity and balance. Like you mentioned, documentary, narrative, comedy, drama. I do prefer narrative features for the International Film Festival. I think we've got maybe 2 documentaries out of 12 films. Mm. But I really love the creativity of a narrative feature. I think you get more interesting cinematic experiences from that. Whether, you know, it's magic realism or fantasy or all those things, you don't really get that in a documentary. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the documentaries almost could be a narrative feature. It's called Agents of Happiness, and it takes place in the country of Bhutan. And Bhutan, as you might know, does not measure gross national product. They measure gross national happiness. And they judge the success of their country, their mountain Himalayan country, based on how happy their people are. And so these two agents are employed by the government to go out into the small remote villages to survey the inhabitants about their happiness.
What an interesting job.
I know. And you know, and also while they're doing this, they're questioning their own happiness, you know, and whether doing what they're doing is really what they want to be doing. And it's hilarious at times because you get such frank and transparent descriptions. And I think for us Westerners, it gives us another view as to how do you judge your life? Mm-hmm. How do you, you know, I think, I forget someone, I was trying to think of this quote that someone said, well, what is happiness? I don't know what happiness is. Mm-hmm. And how do you measure happiness?
How do you measure it? Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And everyone has their own level of it. And do you really know when you're really, truly happy? So even though it's a documentary, it could be a narrative feature.
Yeah. We're talking about the 19th annual Martha's Vineyard International Film Festival. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are getting a preview of the 19th annual Martha's Vineyard International Film Festival, which runs September 3rd through the 8th. With us is the festival's executive director and founder, Richard Paradise. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, one that kind of caught my eye was Lucky Winners. And I was, you have this little, did you know the chance of winning the lottery is 1 in 19 million? And you know, don't we? It's like the dollar for the dreams, right?
Right.
I mean, your chances of winning are so slim, but somebody does win, right?
Of course.
And this is a movie about that.
Yes.
The Lucky Winners, maybe more of a nightmare.
Yes. Well, definitely played for comedy. Yeah. Have you ever played the lottery?
Oh, of course.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Most people have at least once in their life played the lottery.
When it's a big jackpot.
Right.
And your chances
right.
are even less of
right.
winning.
So this movie I saw in Berlin, and it's from France, a French filmmaker, and it's a crazy, crazy film, a black comedy that consists of 4 separate stories. And in each story, the protagonist, either a family or an individual, wins an enormous amount of money, millions, in the millions. But what transpires after they win that dream lottery is not, you know, you would consider a dream life. It becomes a nightmare. And so in each story, I don't want to give too much away, mm-hmm. but in each story, they go on this roller coaster as to what it means to, you know, become super rich after, you know, winning the lottery. And so we've all heard the horror stories,
right.
you know, people win the lottery and, you know, a year later they're living on the street. How could that happen?
Right.
You know, so having money and having money where you're not used to having money people are not prepared for that.
Right.
But this film is crazy in the sense that it uses dark comedy to make the film super entertaining. And it is our opening night, so-called opening reception, opening film, even though the festival starts on Tuesday, but we always have continued to do our so-called opening party on a Thursday.
Yeah.
Because historically, that's when we've
You have an
done
opening
it.
Party and a closing party.
Yes, we have a big tented party on Thursday night right on the lagoon. Beautiful. And then closing night party is actually in town at a restaurant called Fish. They have a beautiful open patio with umbrellas and things. And we always sort of navigate over to downtown. Again, history-wise, we've always kind of ended the festival on Main Street in Vineyard Haven. And the closing film, too, is just beautiful. I saw this at the Tribeca Film Festival. It stars Isabella Hubert, who is one of my favorite international actresses. And it's a bit of a ghost story, romantic drama. And it's set in Japan, which is a country I love. I mean, I've been only once, but I love the culture and the Japanese culture and Japanese filmmaking. So it's quite an interesting film in its own right.
Yeah.
And so
we should mention, and all of this is walkable from the ferry.
Yes.
Right? So
yes.
Do you take into account the ferry schedule with the times that you schedule the films?
No.
No.
No, no. The schedule of the films pretty much are set based on preferences for the audience that I've acquired over many years. You know, we have a 4 o'clock show on a weekday, and we have a 7:30 film. And those two time periods are most successful over the years. And then on Saturday and Sunday, we do start earlier. We do have a 12 or 1 o'clock matinee. And so for individuals who are in Falmouth, for instance, or on the Cape that do want to take the ferry over, it's very easy to come to the ferry in Vineyard Haven. And walk to the film center.
Right.
It's like an 8-minute walk.
And all of the films are going to be screened at the film center.
Correct.
Because I mean, it used to be years ago you were at different locations, but
right.
it's now that you've got this gorgeous
beautiful
film center,
theater,
why not with comfortable chairs?
Yes, comfortable chairs, great sound, great screen,
all the
amenities that you'd want in a modern cinema. We've used to be spread out all over Vineyard Haven, but in all sort of non-traditional locations, non-screening, and I'd have to set up screens and projection and sound and all these different locations. Don't have to do that now.
Yeah.
All to do is turn a switch.
But it's more than just you have help with this, right?
Oh yes, we have a staff. You know, we have volunteers for certain events like the closing and opening parties, but pretty much at the Film Center, we have our, year-round staff, Danny Bork and Michael Nassen, and we have a new colleague that's going to be joining us. She was an intern this summer, and she's going to be staying on full-time, so we're really happy to make her a part of our team. So, yes, we have our staff that will be at the Film Center the entire festival.
I know that you have seen most of these films. So is there something that you're they all sound great, but is there something you're really excited about? One that you just like, I'm so happy to get this film here. You're like, all of them.
Well, yeah. I mean, most of these films are not in sort of theatrical release yet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these films don't even have a film distributor in the United States. So I'm working.
So this is really an opportunity to see something you can't really see anywhere unless you're going to these film festivals.
Right. Like Sidoni and Japan, the closing night film, no distributor yet. Maybe by 2025, it'll be available. I would love to bring that film back. A lot of times I will bring some of these films back in the autumn that seemed to be very successful. But, Sojo, which was from Mexico. It won the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. I mean, this film has not been readily available either. And
what's that one about?
It's about a young boy who experiences his father being killed, murdered by the Mexican drug cartel. And his aunt takes him away. He's 4 years old. He takes him away into a small remote part of Mexico so he can be raised away from the gangs and cartels, because his father was deeply involved in the cartels, but they decided to eliminate him. But as he grows up and becomes a teen, he goes back to Mexico City, and he has to make that decision. Will he follow in his father's footsteps and get into the cartel, or stay out of it? And that's where the story sort of takes off from. The Quiet Maid is a film I saw in Berlin. I just absolutely loved it. It, you know, I don't want to, you know, assume, but, you know, we have a lot of domestic help on Martha's Vineyard. We're in a resort location. And this film takes place sort of in a wealthy family who hires this maid. And, you know, things don't always go right. And I think people will find it very interesting of a film.
This is from Spain, this one?
It's from Spain, yes. And, yeah, I mean, all the films, Gondola. This is the second time we've shown a film from Veit Helma. He's a German filmmaker. Gondola is a film that is like a fantasy. It's a love story. It has no dialogue, Mindy. No dialogue at all. Sounds, music. It's just beautiful. It's surprising. It's whimsical.
I think that'd be tough to pull off.
This is his shtick. This is his MO. His other previous films have all utilized no dialogue.
Wow.
And he just does it way. About 4 years ago at the film festival, we showed a film that he called The Bra. and it was about this man who finds this bra like Cinderella and goes looking for the woman that the bra fits. And he goes through this village, you know, in a very funny way, trying to ascertain who is the owner of this bra. He's a train conductor, and this train goes through the city, and it caught onto a laundry line, and that's how he came to get the bra. But this is just as magical. I think people would absolutely find The Gondola charming. And again, not available in the United States. You know, I saw it in Berlin. And
you're like, gotta have that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it tough to get these? I mean,
Well, yes. I mean, I would say that I get sort of denied or turned away on probably 40 or 50% of the films
really?
That I reach out to. Because again, when you're dealing with a film that does not have a U.S. distributor and is primarily being dealt with through a sales agent, because the sales agent after the festival is wanting to sell it. And so they really do not want a lot of exposure for the film until it's sold.
Right.
So, yeah.
It can be tough, yeah.
There are many films that say, oh, it's too soon. No, we're going to wait until we have a distributor. No, it's not going to be available. Or the other thing, it's just too expensive.
Yeah.
Because sales agents don't really care about, you know, a theatrical release.
All
they
want
to do is sell. Yes. Money.
You mentioned the short film juried competition on Friday. Tell us a little more about that. That's always a favorite of a lot of audiences.
Oh, yes. That always sells out. And this year we had about 275 short film entries, and we have submissions for about 9 months. We gather those submissions, and I have a wonderful committee of film aficionados who watch every single short film.
Wow.
I do not watch them all myself.
Yeah, that's a lot to watch.
275, but they do it over a long period of time. They rank the films, they rate them in different categories, and then when we get to the end, when we've closed submissions, usually middle of July, I ask them to choose their top 15 films out of the 275, in this case, this year. And then I compare each of their notes, their lists, and I try to find consensus. And so from the 9 films, 5 of them were on all 4 of the viewing committee's selections. And the other 4 that make up the 9 were on 3 of the 4. So that's consensus. And so then we make that our finalists program. And we then have a jury that will actually select the best of the festival. And that jury is made up of pretty much professionals, screenwriters, filmmakers. In the case of Sarah Kitchen, she's a 2-time Oscar winner
wow.
for shorts.
Mm.
And so you've got some really good people. We always also ask the last year's winner of the Short Film Festival to come back and be on the jury for this year.
Oh, fun.
So that jury will decide which is the best film of the festival. And then there's a cash prize. And then that person gets to participate the next year. So
yeah,
it's a lot of fun. And we've been doing this for about, out of 19 years, I think we've done it probably 13 or 14 years,
yeah.
not the first 4 or 5 years, but ever since.
It's another an area where you don't get to see a lot of these short films. I mean, you don't see them a lot of places, right? So.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, short films, other than the Oscar-nominated shorts each year, which we show as a program, and this program, and then we also have, luckily enough, I've been working with the Manhattan Shorts Film Festival. We always have that at the end of September. But for the most part, short films are pretty much only seen at film festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see these films also online at some point, but not always. But, you know, how would you know what to look for unless you're going to a film festival and someone has curated them for you?
Yeah, and the longest one is about 20 minutes. So it was anywhere from, let's see, 3 minutes and 51 seconds up to about 20 minutes. And some of these are from the United States.
Yes.
Yes, you got Canada, United States, Netherlands, Egypt,
and
Japan.
Some of them, even though they were so-called USA, they're set in another country,
mm-hmm.
or they might be set in a different language. So, but it is very diverse, and again, it's not my selection; it's the viewing committee selection. And I have to say, some individuals have been on that committee for over 10 years,
wow.
and they just absolutely love doing it. And it's in the program. If you want to mm-hmm. know who's on the committee and who's on the jury, it's in our program.
Yeah. It's a lot of information on your website, which we're going to have a link to on our website.
Fabulous.
So the Martha's Vineyard, the 19th annual Martha's Vineyard International Film Festival is running September 3rd through the 8th. And again, we'll have a link with more information at our website, which is capeandislands.org. Richard Paradise, Festival Executive Director and Founder, thanks for being here and giving us the preview.
It's always so great to be here, and it's making an annual thing.
Good luck with the festival. Coming
up,
we have a new murder mystery set on Cape Cod. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. Joining us now, Van Northcross, to talk about his debut novel, Never Fault a Creature. Hi, Van.
Hi, Mindy. How you doing?
Good. So during your professional career, you wrote lots of press releases, ad copy, brochures, but this is your first novel. So this is a very different kind of writing than you have spent your career doing. So what was that experience like?
Well, it was very liberating, actually. I mean, I always kind of wanted to write a book, but I was always too busy or thought maybe, you know, it wouldn't be a good idea, but yeah, you're exactly right. I spent 45 years writing to this much space or this many words, or and it had to be in on deadline, you know, which is the best thing that I can say about a lot of the things that I wrote is that I got them in on deadline. You know, they weren't great writing or anything, but they were usable because they were there when they needed to be. But, you know, like a lot of wives, over the years, over 40 years of marriage to my wife, Wendy, something would occur to me and I would tell her a story, you know, from my childhood or my college years or whatever. And like a lot of wives, she thought she'd already heard all my stories, you know, but every now and then I'd pull out a name she'd never heard or a story she'd never heard. And she'd say, "Oh my word," she'd say, "you've got to put that in your book." Well, I wasn't writing a book. So, but it's one of those bucket list things, you know, when after I retired, I said, you know, let's give this a whirl. It would be fun to write something, not on deadline, not limited by the number of words, just let it flow, you know.
And something from your imagination, but also your experiences, because you grew up in the South, and this is a murder mystery, and there you have the North and the South involved in this story.
Well, it's one thing you're right. I grew up in the South and I went to school in the South and I was in the workforce before I ever moved to New England. I've lived here on Cape Cod since 1970. I still have pretty large family down South that I visit with some regularity. And I've been struck for 50 years with how much misunderstanding there is, or just wrong attitudes that people in the South have about people in the North, and vice versa, people in the North have about people in the South. I can promise you, everyone down South is not an ignoramus that abuses women and likes blood sports with guns. It's a stereotype that's not true, but it's largely a function of the media, if you think about it. In a movie or a TV show, if they ever want to portray some guy as just a complete doofus, they give him a southern accent, a very thick southern accent. Now, when I go home, or I sit to my home where I grew up, and I'm with my brothers and stuff, they tease me about my Boston accent. Now, obviously, they've never heard of
Listen,
Boston
nobody's
accent.
accusing you of that around here.
Nobody around here, no. But around here, I get teased about my Southern accent. And I don't really think I have much of a Southern accent anymore, although there are certain words that trip me up. I can say insurance, or if I'm not thinking about it, I say insurance, or cement. I can say cement, but if I'm not thinking, I just say cement.
Seaman, right, exactly. All right, so you get into the action early in the book. In the book, we have this fictional town of Shagport, which is a lot like Chatham,
It's a thinly disguised
except
Chatham.
thinly disguised. And it's the height of summer season. Peyton Pomeroy, who's a neurosurgeon at Cape Cod Hospital, is out on a dinner date with her relatively new lawyer boyfriend. And outside, after the restaurant closes, he is gunned down by an assailant with a 9mm Glock. And this is shocking.
It's absolutely shocking, and it's intended to shock. It's a short chapter, like most chapters in the book. They're very short, but it painted a bucolic scene, of a summer day, summer evening on Cape Cod, and people just enjoying the day, enjoying the night air, and then this senseless, absolutely violent murder occurs and kind of sets the tone for the rest of the book.
Right. And now no one has been murdered in this town for 25 years. We have this police chief, John Augustus, who this is his late career job, and he was hoping that the most he'd have to do is maybe bust up some loud parties, right? And he was not expecting to be involved, but he has some experience here. And this is the big question. What, why? Who did this? Why? Like any murder investigation. We're not going to give anything away here, but boy, oh boy, are there some twists and turns in this one.
Yes, there are. We challenge the reader a bit with their own attitudes, but yeah, for sure. And that's one of the sub themes of this book. Something that I've realized over my 45-year career here on Cape Cod, and something I've talked about with my wife Wendy many times, who for many years was the CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber. People look at Cape Cod as a retirement community or a vacation community. They don't realize how hard people work here on the Cape, the working people. And it's one of the things the chief of police in Shagport is surprised at. He thought it was going to be a retirement job, it was going to be easy living, and he was going to go fishing and play golf and dabble in
Wrong.
police work. But people around here, particularly in healthcare or in the tourism industry, they work as hard as anybody on the planet.
Oh, they sure do.
I think when people come here to work, they're a little surprised at how hard you have to work.
So we got the beginning of the book that takes place in this fictional town of Shagport, and then the action switches to Mississippi, and
a bad guy, let's say, who lives, one of the bad guys, who lives on a family plantation. I had two questions here. Why Mississippi? And then tell us a little bit about this plantation, because I think a lot of people would be surprised that we still have people living as they do on some of these old plantations.
Well, it's true. And they tell you, why Mississippi? I'll tell you why. I'm an Ole Miss graduate. They tell you to write what you know. Mm-hmm. This is what I know, is the Mississippi Delta. I know a lot of people down there. And I'll tell you something about the Mississippi Delta. That is some of the richest farmland you'll find anywhere on Earth. The Mississippi River has been overflowing its banks and enriching that soil for hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions of years. And the only place on Earth that's even comparable to it is the Nile River Valley in Egypt. Egyptian cotton is equally desirable as Southern cotton. But the farms that are down there, the farms that they say the Mississippi Delta runs from the lobby of the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, where the famous ducks are in the fountain in the lobby, down to Fish Street in Vicksburg. That's the limits of the Mississippi Delta. And within that region, there are ancient plantations that have been farmed for centuries. And the individual farmers, the people that have grown up farming that land for generations, they've pretty much been priced out, boxed out at this point. The big corporations in the world, they own that farmland now. They farm it. They farm it with equipment that they can plant 5,000 acres with a machine in a week, a machine that costs $1 million or more, you know, and that machine would be used 1 or 2 weeks a year. One modern day tractor with all the attachments you can put on it will displace 8 working families in the Mississippi Delta or anywhere down south, anywhere there are farmlands, down south, Midwest, anywhere. They can't compete with these big corporations. But these are people, as I said, for generations, they've known farming. They're not highly educated. They didn't have access to very good education. They're pretty much stuck. Mm-hmm. You know, where are they going to go? What are they going to do? How are they going to make a living? They're pretty much dependent on government welfare or odd jobs. Some of them, they're making $10,000, $12,000 a year.
Right.
You know, tops. Mm. As I say, they're stuck.
Right.
That's where they are. They really have nowhere to go and no way out.
Right. And so there, we won't get into details, but there is this connection between Shagport and this Mississippi plantation. And as we're trying to figure out what's going on with this murder, now we've got a deadly shark attack.
You had to put
that in there, right? Because of our recent shark population increasing here, right? You had to have that.
Well, the killer in my book needs a cover. He knows that people are looking for him. He knows that if he strikes again, there are going to be lines drawn that he doesn't want drawn. So he needs a good cover, and he waits. Mm-hmm. He waits patiently for something like this. And when the shark attack happens, it's his cover.
That's his chance. Yeah, yeah.
Swing back into action, you know?
Yeah. And so, again, don't want to give away too much here because it's fun to get to these twists and turns. When you started writing this book, talk about this. Did you have this idea of all of these twists and turns in there? Did you want people to go, aha?
You know, Mindy, I really didn't. And I've heard other writers say they created characters and kind of launched them, and they started writing their book, and they really didn't know where it was going to go. And I never believed that. And I still don't believe that. I kind of pretty much had it in mind what my story was going to be. But as I went along, even with the title of the book, I changed the title of the book halfway
Oh.
through for a very good reason. But as these characters, as I put my characters that I created in different situations, I knew how they would react in that situation because I knew their character. And sometimes I was a little surprised. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, well, of course that's what they would do.
Well, and
why didn't you think of that before?
Yeah. You know? And a lot of writers do, authors do talk about that, where they have a character who maybe was supposed to have a small part in the story, but that character just will not stop talking and that ends up with a much bigger part in the book. Did that happen to you?
It absolutely did, yes.
All right, so you mentioned the cover, and people might wonder, looking at the book, why you have a shark in a blazer standing on a crowded beach. And the book's title comes from something an elderly character named Granny Lee says on that plantation, right?
Never fault a creature.
Never fault a creature. Yeah. And tell us why she says that.
Well, that actually came from an incident that happened to me when I was a very, very young boy growing up in Memphis, Tennessee. My family had an elderly, not elderly, but she was domestic help. Her name was Mary. And she was with my family just about the whole time I was growing up. But one time before I'd even started kindergarten, we had a dog. And I was mad at the dog, and I was like yelling at the dog or trying to hit it or something like that. And Mary grabbed me and shook me, and she scolded me. And she said, "You should never fault a creature for doing what it's its nature to do." Now, I couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 years old when that happened. And here I am now in my late 70s telling you this story. Because that's what an impression it made on me in my life. So I put that in my book, and I put those words in the mouth of a character named Granny Lee. And as soon as I wrote it down, I knew that was a better title for my book than anything I had. Mm-hmm. Up until this point, my working title for the book had been Kill Peyton. Bill Peyton was going to be the name of the book.
Oh, you're right. This is better.
As soon as I wrote that down, I realized, you know, this is the overarching theme of my whole book. It's just a story. It's just a murder mystery. At the end of the day, it's just a story that I made up. But the overarching theme in on the title pages of my book, I have on one page, I have one famous quote. Mm-hmm. And the quote is, "No law of the jungle requires moral behavior. Creatures do what instinct dictates to eat and survive." And I'm like, you know what? That is the theme of the whole book. Mm-hmm. The killer, he's, you know, you can't fault that creature. That's all he knows. Mm-hmm. He comes from a criminal family. He's trying to impress people with, and the only way he knows how. You can't blame sharks for attacking people that put on a wetsuit and paddle out on a surfboard and start acting like seals. Mm-hmm. They're just looking for something to eat.
Yeah.
You know, they're not looking to kill people.
Yeah, and I was saying, Granny Lee tells us she's talking to a young woman who's upset because a cat has been killing her coop chickens. So, yeah, so it's the same kind of thing. So there is this underlying theme of nature versus nurture.
Right, exactly so.
Yeah.
It's one of several themes that I have through the book. But again, it's not like anything that I want to hit people over the head with. It's there to consider if you want to consider it. If you don't want to consider it, it doesn't interfere with the story. The story moves right along, you know, to its conclusion.
Yeah. What about character development? Are these characters people that are shades of people that you knew, or are they strictly from your imagination?
Oh, no, they're absolutely shades of people that I knew. And several of the characters are mashups of several people that I knew, you know, but one or two, maybe I made them up whole cloth, you know, because I needed them. I needed them to do different things. But one or two of them, like the lawyer there in Mississippi, it might be a stereotype, you mm-hmm. know. I I worried about that a little bit. It's but at the end of the day, I just needed him. I needed him to do what he was doing, you know.
He had to be a little shady to do what he was doing. Yeah.
I didn't worry about it too much because the lawyers are kind of fun to beat up on.
And then you also have this theme of misogyny in the book as well.
I do. They, you know, there's so many women in my life that I have so much respect for. Both my grandmothers, my mother was an outstanding example to me my whole life. My wife, Wendy, is someone that I admire greatly. My daughter, Alexis, and my two granddaughters, Kate and Lainey, they're just really good, smart, hardworking, moral people, you know, and they deserve to be recognized. They deserve support. We do better in this country than a lot of countries in the world. I realize that. But we've still got a long way to go. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit in the book that I use to challenge people. And again, like you said, I don't want to give too much away, but I've had people that I know really well call me up when they get to a certain point in my book or email me, you know, and say, wow, I didn't see that coming, yeah. You know.
There's
I know
a exactly, lot you don't see coming, yeah.
I know exactly what they're talking about, but that's on them. That's on them because the reason they were shocked by that is because of their own attitudes mm-hmm. about things, particularly about women.
Yeah. All right. So there's, like I said, twists and turns, and there's a couple of times I'm going, whoa, I thought I was done with the twists and the turns, yet there is one at the end of the book, which kind of left this little opening for a sequel. And I went, are you planning that? Or did you just go, oh, you know what, I'm just in case, I'm going to leave this open.
Well, you know, let me say this about that, Mindy. You know, I'm a great fan of, I don't read a lot of fiction. Most of what I read, as you well know, is history. And I'm trying to read at least one book about every president. I've got a thing about presidents. But, and it's kind of funny that I would write a book of fiction and not read that much fiction. But I do read John Grisham. Mm-hmm. I've read almost everything John Grisham has ever written. And I might have been a classmate of his had I gone to law school at Ole Miss like I was originally planning. But I don't like the way he ends his books. Mm. He comes up with great scenarios, you know, and you go, oh, wow, this is good. But he even stopped selling his books to Hollywood because when they made movies out of his books, they were changing the endings. Mm. And I can't blame him. I'm not a fan of his endings either. From about the last third of his books on, you know exactly where it's going. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly where it winds up. Well, I just wasn't going to do that with my book. It's not real life. Mm-hmm. I mean, think right. about it. Something happens to you, you have an experience, you have a story, you tell the story, but the next morning you get out of bed and it's a new day. Life goes on. It's not like you reach an end point and everybody lives happily ever after. Everybody doesn't live happily ever after. The next day, things continue happening.
Yeah, and it does make you wonder. It makes you wonder, what's next? So that's why.
Exactly. What comes next? Yeah. They're going to be good things. They're going to be bad things. But it's never everyone lived happily ever after. That just, it's not real life.
The book is Never Fault a Creature. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Van Northcross, thanks for being with us. And thanks for writing such an entertaining book.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.